It's good to stay sexually pure in your single stage, in your single season. It's not weird. It's not bad. It's not un-American. It's not abnormal. God says that that is good. Now, I know what society says, and I know what our culture says, but what does God say? And it is not, you know, something to ignore.
You know, the word sex is not a sinful word. It's actually a beautiful word when applied in the proper context. Sex is a drive that God has given for both men and women. And what makes it beautiful and enjoyable is when it's in the context of marriage. Anything outside of God's design is sinful, ugly, and always brings great harm in every area of our being. And today on Seeds of Commitment, Lance Cook will talk about the scriptural facts about sex and marriage, and the lasting benefits that sex brings in a healthy and happy marriage. Our Bible reference can be located in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, as we consider some practical insights in this chapter. With today's broadcast of Seeds of Commitment, here's Lance.
It was fascinating. We have three weekend services last night. Our Saturday night was just a great group of people, and I, you know, I began to just look down at this chapter, and I was praying, and I looked up, and the first person I looked at when I began to teach on marriage was my mom. I thought, now this is only something that a God with a great sense of humor can do. But we are about to go into a topic that I believe requires some serious, candid approach. I think it needs to be approached in a culture, in an environment that is so open and explicit as far as representing the wrong views of morality and sex and marriage and all of that. In an environment just like Corinth, we today have just an openness in the areas of morality and immorality. And so I think we as the church should be able to come to these specific chapters wide open, man, full throttle, candid, to where we're sitting back saying, that's what God's word says about that? Absolutely. Sometimes we let the world do all of the talking for us, and I think that's wrong. And so we have admitted when we came to chapter 5, when it was reported in the church in Corinth, that there was actually sexual immorality among them. We said, hey, these next few studies, as we talk about sex, as we talk about the moral issues surrounding marriage and the single life, we are going to be open. We are going to go through and teach these chapters. Some of you have bought commentaries from time to time, books where authors have given their comments on the Bible. They've broken down passages. And it's interesting to go into some of these more challenging passages with some of the more popular commentators even, and see that they just kind of summarize some of these, you know, particularly challenging chapters. A lot of those commentaries are, you know, sermons that were given in pulpits. But we're going to go straight at it, and we're going to look at it just as it is written. And I believe there is much needed insight and direction for marriage, for future marriages, and for those that might even feel a call to singlehood. A quick read through chapters 1 through 6 would leave anybody with the conclusion that Jesus Christ obviously wanted his body to be a spiritual body. He obviously wanted them to be a unified body. He wanted them to be a very servant-minded body, a serving body, and then a sanctified body and a forgiving body. Qualities and virtues that would have marked the church in Corinth at one time. But now they have become a carnal body, not so much growing spiritual, but becoming more fleshy. They had become a divided body, a selfish, self-centered body, an immoral body, an in or unforgiving body, seen in our last time together in chapter 6 with the various lawsuits that began to intimidate this body. A defiled body is something that you sense as well as you go through chapter 6. Rather than being an influence on the world, they allowed the world's influence to come in and affect the body. Now in chapter 7, Paul begins to deal again with the specific topic of marriage. When we begin chapter 7, not going to jump into it right now, but in the first verse it says, concerning the things of which you guys wrote me. The founding pastor, Paul the Apostle, was on his third missionary journey upwards around the area of Ephesus when he got the concerning news about the church that he had founded in Corinth. Obviously, hey, the body is divided. Hey, there's all these lawsuits. Hey, that news came to him. But it also came with some questions. And so in chapter 7, it seems that Paul begins to address some specific questions that maybe even came up within the church. Chapter 7, marriage. Chapters 8 through 10, Christian liberty. What can we do? What should we not be doing now that we are Christians? Conduct in the church, chapter 11 specifically. And then the spiritual gifts. They had questions about the spiritual gifts. They had problems regarding spiritual gifts, chapters 12 through 14. Then chapter 15, the classic chapter on resurrection. Man, there was all kinds of different philosophies of the world coming in regarding resurrection. Paul will set them straight by bringing out the supreme resurrection, that of Jesus Christ. Then in chapter 16, the topic of Christian stewardship, the issue of giving within the church, financially supporting the church, tithe and offering and Christian stewardship will be dealt with. And then that of stumbling people. What about meat that's been offered to idols? Shall we eat that? Shall we not eat that? Women's role in the church and obedience to communion, the Lord's Supper, you see. All of these issues we will venture down and discover when we go through this particular book. But now we are camped out on the topic of marriage. Problem. The world's view, the world's philosophy on marriage had crept into the church. Many of those views began to be accepted and even practiced within the church. A lot of people wonder, what was marriage like back in the days of Paul, back in that biblical era? Well, it's easy to even go down in secular history and begin to investigate what was marriage all about. The Roman Empire, well, it had laws. And many of those laws, well, they were applied to marriage. There were four kinds of marriages that seemed to mark the Roman Empire. Four parts of marriage that were somewhat accepted as norm. One was what they called the tent marriage. It was reserved for slaves. They called it the tent marriage because it was a temporal thing. It was controlled by the master. The master arranged the marriages. The master, you know, set the duration of time on the marriage. The master could sell a spouse out of a marriage and into another marriage. So there was that accepted form of marriage in the Roman Empire during this time, during this season. Then, of course, there was what they called the usus. That was a form of common law within marriage. It was, if a person was married for at least 1 year, then, you know, the law just stated, well, then they, of course, are married. Some marriages, a third form was more of the arranged marriage, where a father would sell his daughter into marriage. That was an accepted form of marriage as well. Then there was the more typical marriage, which we would be familiar with. The Greek word is kaphoretio. And that was a marriage which involved a ceremony of a bride and a groom. They had a groomsman, a bridesmaid. They had witnesses. They actually came together. This is where the veil came into practice, in the Roman culture at least. They exchanged vows. They exchanged rings. They had a big banquet. They even had a wedding cake. So those were kind of the norms of marriage. But then there was just the general philosophy, the mindset of the culture regarding marriage. Gnosticism was prevalent in Paul's day. The Gnostics, they were these individuals that ran around with what they called supreme knowledge. The word gnosis, to know. They were the knowers. They said that their knowledge was superior to all. They taught that knowledge was superior to faith. They taught that even ever, you know, getting right with God, it was all based on knowledge. It had nothing to do with faith. Faith was inferior. They were the knowers. They had the secret insights. Well, there was two sects of the Gnostics. One was an antinomianistic sect. The antinomianist was one who ran around basically saying that, you know, moral law was not valid for a person or for a group. There's no real moral compass. There's no real moral laws that should govern your life or govern groups. They claim that the spiritual Christians, that the church, you know, were not even responsible for what they did. They really couldn't even sin. Thus, they can act in any way that they pleased. They did not fear God. They did not fear His judgment. They felt that they would not, of course, invoke a wage of judgment from God. They thought that anything physical and material was evil. Only spiritual things were good. So if your body was evil, no good, pure thing could come from it. So what does it matter? What you do with your body. It's the no rules, the no boundaries kind of mindset that we even saw in our own society in the 60s. Then there was a second group of Gnostics that called themselves the ascetics. The ascetics felt that, well, the body was so evil, you had to really restrain it. If you were married, you had to restrain from any form of sexual activity with your spouse because the body is evil. The appetites, the drive of the body is evil. So they felt that they had to overcome the body. And so down goes a few popular names in history. One such ascetic by the name of Barsabbas. He bound himself in chains, hands behind his back, feet together, for 40 years to refrain his body. There was another individual who lived in a tower for 32 years. Another man who sat in a swamp naked for 4 months. Mass confusion came from these groups. Sadly, the pagan confusion crept into the church, along with these misconceptions of marriage. All of that crept into the church. Divorce. It was very, very common in those days. In the Roman Empire, it was not uncommon for men and women to have been married 20 times or more. To give you an idea of what the church was up against, to give you an idea of what the norm, what the accepted was within their culture, these are the kind of challenges the early church was facing. Multiple marriages, multiple divorces. The Jews were even known for divorcing their wife for the littlest of things. I asked for 2 falafels. You gave me 1. I'm going to go down and sign that certificate of divorce. You burnt my toast. Same thing. They would divorce their wife for any little reason. So, the much needed direction. What do we do now that we're believers, Paul? Should we stay together as husband and wife, as Christians? What should we do if one of us is not a believer and the other one now is? Should we, as single people, marry or should we remain single? All of these questions. So Paul, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, begins to pin down these thoughts. Verse 1, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, because it's prevalent in society, and as we saw in chapter 5, it's also prevalent in the church and tolerated in the church, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." That phrase, "a man to touch a woman," was a common Jewish euphemism, which basically meant sexual intercourse. Paul is saying that it is not good for a man to engage with a woman sensually or sexually or romantically outside of the marriage covenant. He says in verse 2, "Therefore, or however, because there is that desire naturally, because there is that strong drive that God has put within us, God has made a provision for that particular drive, for that particular sexual activity, and it is, again, the confines of marriage. There are going to be those who will not restrain themselves. They haven't been given the gift of celibacy, so God, of course, has this provision for marriage. Now, there comes a time for most people when they hit a stage in their life when they begin to start noticing the opposite sex. I'm going to talk candidly here again. This happened with me when I was probably, 13 or 14. Yes, God was important. My family was important. The other two things that really stood out were food. I loved to eat when I was a kid. And then surfing. Man, that's all I thought about was surfing. The magazines that I read was surfing. All my friends were surfers. All my spare time, surfing, surfing, surfing. I dreamt surf. It was all about surfing. Man, if you came and talked to me about girls when I was 13, I'd say, do they surf? Do they even exist? Do they live on the planet? But boy, when I was about 14, this thing that God had put in me, it began to awaken. And all of a sudden, I realized girls were on the planet, the same planet. And then Sue at our church was now Susie. I don't even know what happened. My dad didn't sit me down and say, now, boy, you're 14. And let me tell you what you got to start thinking like now. Man, I was wired this way. God put this in me, but there was this biological clock, and it went off. I remember my brother, he was a couple of years older, some of you know my older brother Lee, and he was already there. You know, I'm talking early 70s here, okay, so track with me here. My brother was already there. He woke up a couple of years earlier, and he was already wearing the polyester tight pants, platform shoes. I remember my brother, you know, we had shared the same bathroom. He used to reach over and put this stuff on. Never noticed it, but it was called cologne. Some of you guys remember musk? I remember the first time I reached over there and I grabbed musk. Let me tell you why I put on musk. Because I saw girls gravitate towards my brother because he wore musk. And I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to be acknowledged all of a sudden in my youth group. So I pulled out the musk and I put it up, burned my eyes and everything the first time. Man, I don't know what happened. I didn't used to care how I dressed. I just wear these OP corduroy shorts, sandals, Hawaiian shirts. Haven't changed much, but that's what I would wear back then. And all of a sudden, I'm like pulling out one of my brother's shirts out of his closet. Tight polyester shirt. I remember the girls. I heard the girls talking about puka shells. They look cool on guys. I went out and bought two necklaces. Guys, I bought a necklace for girls to get their attention. Uncomfortable, jabbed you. But I wore them. And my hair, you know, the surfers back then, you just kind of left your hair a little bit messy, pulled it off to the side. That was a big thing. But then you began to part your hair down the middle. The guys, that was in. And if that wasn't goofy, and sorry if you got a hair parted down the middle, you look really good. But back then, it was goofy. Back then, you would even go to your barber and say, can you feather my hair? Guy feathers his hair today, man, they're going to lock you up. Feather the hair. Why? Girls. I remember that movie, The Blue Lagoon, came out. This really pretty girl named Brooke Shields was in that movie. Pretty eyebrows and everything. Ooh. And this guy, he looked like me, but he had curly hair. I never seen so many surfers go out and perm their hair. I permed my hair. I got a picture. Yeah, that's right. Look good, man. Come to church, everybody's like, what the heck happened to that guy? Why? My first date. You going that far back? Yeah. I watched the best on TV. Danny Partridge. Greg Brady. Chachi. I knew what to do. My brother and pastor's son, they were a little older and they were starting to, you know, corporately go out as groups. And they said, Lance, there's a girl at church, got her eye on you. The musk worked, yeah. Like that parted hair. So I said, all right, let's all get together. So we met at my house and had my dad's car and big old Chevy Impala, and they kind of orchestrated the whole thing. We're all going to go down the beach, walk along the beach. And so they told me, you know, it'd be really cool, you know, if you get in the car, put your arm around her. All right, I think I can do that. Got in the car. I'd never been so scared in my life. I didn't put my arm around her. All the way down to the beach, they're all, come on, go for it, go put your arm around her. And they're all, you know, that first date, all the guys trying to look cool. I wouldn't do it. It's like the high dive. The longer you stand there, the harder it got. Finally, I build up enough courage. We're walking down the beach, took off our shoes, rolled up our pants, and the little tide's coming in. And I'm like, okay, and I'm walking out in front of these guys. And true story, I finally, you know, I'm there, and I put my arm around this girl, you know, and okay, I did it. And then the water comes, I start running. Here comes the water, and I pulled us both into this big hole that some kid dug that day, and it was filled with water. Boom, down we went. So, true story. There's no evangelistic stretching in that at all. True story. But all of that to say that's my time, that was my season, when those hormones, when that drive, when that desire began to be awakened within me, and we all have our story, we all have that time, we all have that place when those hormones began to wake up, those passions and desires that God put in each and every one of us for companionship, for acceptance. It says in the book of Genesis that God looked at Adam and he says, it's not good that he is alone. God saw the loneliness of Adam and said, it's not supposed to be that way. There's Mr. and Mrs., you know, giraffe, Mr. and Mrs., ox, Mr. and Mrs., gorilla, but there's Mr. Adam. And he was lonely, and God saw that because he was wired for companionship. And understand this, single people. We're going to talk about marriage, but we're going to talk a whole lot about the single life, both this morning and especially Wednesday night as well. But understand, God brought Eve to Adam. It was God guiding. It was God's timing. That is important. And there was a specific purpose for both of them. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But a desire to know a girl, a desire to court and fall in love with a girl, a desire to get married, a desire to be sexually intimate, the desire to have babies, the desire to have a family, all of that is the natural plan of God, the natural order of God, the natural intention of God, and it's all designed in this beautiful covenant, this thing that he calls marriage. And so Paul says, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. It's good to stay sexually pure in your single stage, in your single season. It's not weird. It's not bad. It's not un-American. It's not abnormal. God says that that is good. Now, I know what society says, and I know what our culture says, but what does God say? And it is not, you know, something to ignore. And then in verse 2, Paul begins to say again, nevertheless, because of sexual immorality. Paul's warning against sexual immorality. The single life sexual desire is unfulfilled. God knows that. For you single people, you know that. Thus, the temptation can be very strong, especially in societies that just plaster sensuality everywhere you look, like Corinth and like our society as well. So because of sexual immorality, and that word in the Greek is porneia, where we get our word pornography, fornication, and sexual immorality from. Because of porneia, let a man have his own wife and a woman her own husband. Now note, marriage is not simple or simply God's escape valve for the sex drive. Paul does not suggest that Christians go out and find another Christian to marry only to keep themselves from sexual immorality. That's not what he's saying at all. Paul had a much higher view of marriage than that. You could tell by going through Ephesians chapter 5 what his view of marriage is. His purpose here is to stress the reality of the sexual temptations of singleness and to acknowledge that they have a legitimate outlet in marriage. Therefore, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Single people, God's guiding and God's timing are imperative here. Trust me. Listen up. If you don't hear anything else, please grasp this, what I'm about to say, you single people. I have been married for 17 years. I got married when I was 27. I met my wife when I was 24. When I think about that and I look back on that time and on that season, I absolutely in my heart knew when I asked Lori to marry me that she was the one. And that is important. I had that inner conviction that this is right, that she is the one. I had that inner peace. I had that conviction. I could never see her with anybody else. She is to be mine. God made this woman to come into my life and to be my wife, as my completer, as my best friend, as my soulmate. I knew it. It was there. And 17 years, three kids, three girls, that is, and one male dog named Buddy later, I am absolutely all the more convinced that she is the right one. She is God's choice. And that inner peace and that inner confidence of knowing that God gave me this gal is there.
Well, today on Seeds of Commitment, Lance Cook has been teaching us the scriptural facts about sex and marriage and the lasting benefits that sex brings in a healthy and happy relationship, as we've been learning in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, if you'd like to receive this study on audio cassette or compact disc in its entirety, mention tape number 4602-17. That's 4602-17. Credit card purchases can be made by simply calling us here at Seeds of Commitment. The number is 714-441-2845. Again, that's 714-441-2845. We accept Visa, MasterCard, and Discover Card. If you're mailing a check to us, you can mail it to Seeds of Commitment, 1370 South Euclid Street, La Habra, California, 90631. That's Seeds of Commitment, 1370 South Euclid Street, La Habra, California, 90631. And then make it a point to join with Lance Cook for more rich commentary in the letter of 1 Corinthians, right here on Seeds of Commitment. Until then, we encourage you to stay committed to the Word of God.